case of Tracy McCarter, District Attorney Alvin Bragg saying, I cannot reasonably conclude that this was intentional murder, and I do not wish to seek these charges. And these would not have happened had there not, again, been a tremendous outpouring of support and organizing and advocacy from people, including family members of both Breisha Meadows and Tracy McCarter. But what we're seeing around the country doesn't necessarily play out in the same way. What we've seen in California, there's a case of a woman named Wendy Howard who shot her abusive ex, who had been investigated by police for sexually abusing two of her daughters. And she was acquitted of all charges except for one. And the district attorney has the option of bringing that bringing her to trial for that new charge. In the case of Tracy McCarter, the district attorney has said that he does not want to pursue
these murder
charges.
And Vicki, we just have 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. What do you think the judge is going to rule? She said she'll rule by the end of the week, Judge Giesel.
Well, I certainly hope that the judge rules in favor of the motion to dismiss and doesn't waste city resources further punishing a survivor for surviving violence from her husband.
Victoria Lowen, thank you so much for being with us. Journalists who focus on the intersections of incarceration, gender, and resistance will link to your coverage of this case for The Nation. And that does it for our show. A very special happy birthday to Dina Guzder. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
It's Giving Tuesday, the international holiday where we all give back. Unleash your radical generosity and donate to KBOO Community Radio right now at kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. This Giving Tuesday, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $5,000 thanks to the generous support of KBOO member Jeff Sackett. Double the impact of your gift today. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:01 a.m. on a Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your host, Tracy Simmons. Stay tuned.
Good morning. Welcome to Too Much Information with myself this morning, Tracy Simmons. My amazing co-host is on the fronts today. So it's just me, and hopefully you listeners will call in and keep me company, because this is a hard hustle to keep the show going by myself. So once again, it is Giving Tuesday. And, we're going to talk about some ways we can give back in the community. We'll have a little conversation about what's going on in Oregon with the lack of public defenders and how that is really causing a huge kink in the legal system here in Oregon, and specifically in Portland, Oregon, but it's affecting the whole state. And then I have a question for the listeners. So last week, Abe and I shared a plan for the Portland City Council to spend $27 million. So think about, we were going to spend some money. They want to spend money to concentrate all of the houseless people into encampments. Now, think about encampments. It's 2022. Terrible idea. But I want you to call in and tell me if you had $27 million to spend, to have some kind of impact on the houseless challenges that we have in our city, what would you do? Because I feel like, you know, we're a very smart group of people, the folks who listen to KBOO Radio, listeners of this program specifically, and we might have some good ideas for the city council to consider, given that we know that nothing will get better by creating more harm to the houseless community by packing them into encampments where there's a pooling of poverty and poverty trauma. So ruminate on that. Please call in with your suggestions. And I hope that this is being listened to by the right kinds of people who might be able to intervene in what's happening in the minds of our community leaders. So, yes, the question is, if you had $27 million to spend to support the houseless community and to remedy some of the challenges our city and state experiences, because we have so many people unhoused and we have systematically failed those people, what would you do to try and create a better outcome and potentially offer a solution to this challenge? I want your best thinking. So just shifting, right, we're going to talk today about the public defender crisis that is overtaking the legal system here in the state of Oregon. And I want us to really be also thinking about, once again, this program, Abe and I spend a lot of time talking about the people who need most protection in our society. And this might be a sensitive topic, of course, because, right, we're talking about people who have committed some kind of crime. They still, as a part of our Constitution and our society, deserve and are legally guaranteed, and I say that in air quotes, representation, right? So we're going to talk about that. And once again, I invite you to call. The number to call is 503-231-8187. And you can check in with your answer to the question, how would you spend that $27 million? Or you can join the conversation about the public defender crisis. So switching to the topic at hand, right, this has been going on for quite some time. It's not a new problem. Early in May of 2022, I think many of the local news organizations, Willamette Week for sure, of course, KGW, some of the others started like creating this understanding that there's something going on with the Oregon public defender shortage. So this isn't a new problem, but it's becoming worse and worse by the day. What we've seen is, of course, that we have people that are considered indigent, right? Those are people who don't have enough money to pay for their own legal defense when they are accused of a crime, indicted for a crime, and sitting in jail waiting to be seen, waiting for a trial to happen. And because, you know, the Constitution legally guarantees, and it's part of the Miranda rights, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to an attorney. If an attorney, if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided to you, right? That's all part of our system. And it allows for people, especially the people who have the least, who are more likely, because of their own visibility and because of their own living situation, to be targeted by the police. So we've also shared data about the fact that I think in 2019, over 50% of the arrests in Multnomah County were of houseless people, right? So we are talking about a similar population, right? But those people who are guaranteed legally a person to support their case have not been getting them, right? And so we have you know, Mike Schmidt, the Multnomah County District Attorney, basically saying, like, this is an urgent threat to public safety, right? We're being inundated with, you know, the media, and if it bleeds, it leads kind of you know, storytelling kind of reporting that's making everyone really on edge about their own safety, the safety of their property, I want to name that, you know, the business community is up in arms as well, because of course business owners are making really hard decisions. If, you know, your insurance isn't covering the fact that, you know, every few months you're getting windows broken out, or your, you know, place is being vandalized or robbed potentially, you know, you're getting really frustrated with the lack of what feels like effort to protect your own property and your business. And to business owners are making really hard decisions, leaving the city, shutting down, closing, all of that. So this is all of, right, we're always talking about systems here. But, you know, recently the Associated Press has picked up this story. And so now it's becoming more nationally known, all of the challenges that are happening in the city and in the county and in the state. So Mike Schmidt just released the fact that, of course, some of the numbers, right? So 700 people statewide have no legal representation. Oftentimes that means folks are sitting in jail, waiting for a public defender to even begin adjudicating their case, right? So we see then the numbers in the jails continue to rise, and people not really having any support. So if they are talking, which they often are, they are probably doing that without legal counsel and likely trying to represent themselves. Now, we know there's an old adage about, you know, only a fool would try and represent themselves in court. And of course, a person who doesn't have financial resources, because of course our system is set up to benefit people who do, they're more likely to be charged, tried, and convicted for crimes over a person who has strong legal counsel that can often get them out of jail early, that can often negotiate some kind of deal, that can often get them out of jail without ever going to trial, right? That can set aside a case, all of that, right? So these folks are literally not getting that kind of support. So what we see is this churning out of negative impacts and outcomes for, you know, people who have been systematically under-resourced. When we go down to more of the numbers, so Multnomah County has recently dismissed nearly 300 cases due to a lack of defense attorneys able to handle those cases. So what happens is, if you have someone in jail for so long and they don't have legal defense, the county can't move forward, and then the jails are filled up. So in order to get those people out, the county is making a decision to dismiss those cases, right? And I am absolutely just going to say this, that, you know, not all poor people are criminals. If anyone's hearing me say that, it's absolutely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that these particular people are now then not being held accountable for whatever they've done or proposed to have done, right? You're innocent until proven guilty. And they're being put right back out on the street because those cases can't move forward, and they can't just stay in jail forever, right? It's a huge public safety, community health challenge and potential threat to have people who are known to likely have committed crimes, right? Allegedly, we say that in air quotes as well, allegedly committed crimes, going to jail for a very short period of time, their case being dismissed, and then they're right back out on the street with, you know, of course, no support, because the jail system itself is super problematic about, you know, providing anything that people need as far as mental health support, behavioral health support, financial support. None of that is happening inside the jail. You get three hots and a cot. And hot is also questionable, right? I think here in Multnomah County, it might be like an apple and some milk. I'm not even sure. But the last time I went, So we're talking about now that more than two-thirds of those dismissed cases are felonies, right? So 53% of them are property crimes. Those were the primary charges. And then, of course, weapons crimes, which accounted for 16% of those 300 dismissed cases. That's kind of scary. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, potential crimes against other humans. So assault and robbery accounted for 12 to 13% of those other crimes, right? So over half are felony crimes. And then when we start talking about what becomes a public safety threat, of course, is the assault and robbery, right? That's scary. That's scary that you have folks who potentially have committed a crime like that against another person being released out and not ever seeing trial for a crime that they committed. What we know about crimes against other persons is that typically if someone is going to commit a crime like a robbery or assault, it's unlikely that they'll be like, oh yeah, I learned my lesson, right? Didn't go to jail. I went to jail, but I didn't get, you know, I have no consequence for this. This is getting dismissed. Now I'm back on the street, right? Frightening, y'all. It's frightening. So I want to continue, you know, inviting folks to think about, like, what's the solution here? What do we do about this? And ultimately, you know, how do we also stop the narrative that it is on part of our progressive district attorney and Mike Schmidt that this crime is happening? Because what we're seeing nationwide, and we saw this in San Francisco, that, you know, progressive DAs are under attack for their policies to try and reform the legal system itself. And the legal system is fighting back by creating these kinds of situations. Not to say that this is all created, but this situation is spiraling out of control because we can't keep enough public defenders on deck. And that leads us also back to the question about, you know, the professionalization of the legal system, how that, of course, is a weed out system. When you think about, you know, taking the bar exam, who can afford to, you know, pay for law school? Who, you know, gets even selected to go to law school, because it's a highly selective process in and of itself, right? So that juris doctorate, right? Who gets that to even become a public defender? And of course, because public defenders, because they are serving the indigent, in air quotes, they're less likely to get paid well. And so what happens is you have very new lawyers who will likely plead down cases, will likely do whatever they can to protect their client, but also to protect their own reputation, because they want to ultimately get a better job doing, you know, the work of an attorney. And so they don't stay very long, right? It's a once again, a system-wide issue. So I'm going to keep talking about this, but I invite you to call in, share your perspective. What would you do with the $27 million? What's your take on this whole legal system problem with the lack of public defenders, and what should we be doing about any of these things? The number to call is 503-231-8187. Let me hear from you.
We have heard from JD, who I believe is waiting patiently to speak with us.
Yay! JD!
JD, oh, well, go ahead. Hi. You're on.
Can you hear me? Oh, can you hear me? Oh,
we
excellent.
Can hear you.
Yes, I'm reasonably well. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I was just responding to some issues, basically at the intersection of the public defense crisis and the housing crisis, if I had $27 million to spend in public money, I would do what cities like Salt Lake have done and provide housing, which I believe would resolve a number of crises that related to, like, basically related to being unhoused and the survival situations that stem from that. It's shown that, you know, simply providing housing to the unhoused reduces incarceration. It reduces crime overall. It reduces hospitalization, especially emergency hospitalization. And this goes doubly if SROs, studios, apartments, what have you, are combined with public health services, as has been promised, though. I'm a little concerned about where that's going to go with the recent election of Rene Gonzalez, who was on record as sort of chomping at the bit to quote unquote get people into the criminal justice system. He has this very carceral vision for the very for Portlanders that are most at risk. I've heard things like using the phrase sex trafficking in a very weasel wordy sort of way. What I think we're supposed to believe is that people are being pimped, or that they are being trafficked or sold into sexual servitude. But in reality, this is probably more of a survival sex level of transactional sex, which I think would be in addition to other behaviors that they want to criminalize, nonviolent behaviors like drug dealing on a small time level, just basically any kind of black market transaction that would go on with unhoused people. This is basically punishing them for being outside of the outside of the formal economy, which they, by virtue of being homeless, have been sort of priced or in many ways legally prohibited from joining. You can't really get a job if you don't have an address.
Absolutely.
So I think I honestly see all of this being rooted in Portland's housing crisis. I have been unhoused occasionally. Thank God I have had the opportunity to couch surf, but the way that the language that I'm seeing being used to describe the recidivism of people who are in desperate economic straits is upsetting to me. And I believe that if we spent money on housing the people whose housing situation is in the greatest crisis, we would see the need for public defense and prosecution go way down, as has been shown in other cities nationwide and globally. I think that is the Portland way. It's odd to see Salt Lake, which I consider to be the sort of conservative competitor to Portland in terms of a public urban policy laboratory, leading the standard for housing and care in this situation. But I mean, that's basically, I think, the long and the short of my take. I can take I don't know if you have any questions or if you want me to take them off the air or.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. You know, I will continue. But you have such a good point. The way that we've handled this is Band-Aids. And, right, if you're going to spend $27 million, spend it on giving people houses. Like, what are we doing? Build something. Use a broken-down old hotel, whatever it is. Get people housed. It becomes a spiral of spending that doesn't actually solve for anything. It actually creates more harm and exacerbates the problem. So I totally agree with you, JD. Thank you so much for your call. So, you know, according to the Associated Press, as of Wednesday, right, and of course Wednesday was the day before Thanksgiving, there were 763 low-income defendants who lacked legal representation in the state. Once again, that's a lot of cases. And I think about the victims, the people who were victimized by these alleged crimes, who will see no recourse anytime soon if those public defenders do not materialize, right? And their case is basically going very nowhere, pretty much, until something gives, right? Of course, right, the cracks have been there for a long time, but the backlogs have significantly worsened. And we attribute a lot of that to the pandemic, right? People had some kind of revelation about the work that they were doing, the quality and type of work that they were doing. And we saw large numbers of folks in the public defender's office who were overwhelmed, who were frustrated, who, you know, were, you know, fully traumatized by the work that they had been doing and made a decision to leave. So according to the American Bar Association, a report that was in January, Oregon only has 31% of the public defenders it needs to run effectively, right? This is a quote from the AP article that every existing attorney would have to work more than 26 hours a day during the work week to cover the caseload. I mean, just imagine that, right? So we have people who are desperately needed, a very small number of them still doing the work, and an expectation on them that they're going to be working 26 hours a day. There aren't 26 working hours in a day, right? So this is, I'm just trying to express the gravity of this problem that we're seeing that continues to get worse. Of course, you know, it's literally, you know, as we think about, you know, the victims and what they're going to do likely is put pressure and move even further to the right to put pressure on, you know, future elections and future candidates about what they would like to see, as opposed to even understanding how this whole systemic issue continues to you know, happen and be exacerbated. And we've seen that, right? I don't think Rene Gonzalez got elected on accident, right? We've seen, and I've, you know, made the commentary regularly about, you know, kind of how next door and the media itself have really kind of positioned the city to focus on the crime as opposed to the root causes. And of course, you know, as people who are part of the electoral process, there's a reactionary, you know, kind of drive to, like, no, we're going to focus on the crime, because I think that is how the media is portraying all of this, right? That it is an issue of crime. It's not an issue of people that have been systematically failed, have not been given the resources that they need, have been literally placated by, like, here's a tent, you know, go somewhere else. Right, not in front of my business, that kind of thing. And so we've not ever really tried to solve the problem. And now we have city leadership that, instead of spending that $27 million wisely, is really trying to build, you know, Hoovervilles. I mean, I don't even know what else to call it. But if you think back into the 1920s and the Great Depression, you know, there were literally places in America that were like encampments of very, very poor people. And what we know about the trauma of poverty is that when you concentrate a whole bunch of very under-resourced people in a very small place, right, what you see is more harm befalling those people. And I even think about, you know, like the murder rates in Portland. Our houseless community are the people in most need of protection because they are the most vulnerable to people who would do another person harm. And so we've seen that. We've seen that this year. We've Abe and I talked a while back about, you know, who are the people who have died in Portland on Portland streets, and many of them, many, if not probably most, are people who have been unsheltered and vulnerable to other humans. So once again, right, this is a snowball effect of systemic issues that continue to be unaddressed, unsolved. And because it's Giving Tuesday, what I'm encouraging my listeners to do is really think about, you know, who are the organizations, unfortunately, because the process of, you know, our policymakers are using to address the issues is not effective. We have to rely on philanthropy. And so I want you to consider, if you are able, and of course give to KBOO so that we can continue bringing you amazing community programming, but also think about, you know, the community organizations that are actually stepping in to provide solutions, that are getting folks housed, getting folks sheltered, getting to the root causes of the challenge, whether that's providing mental health, behavioral health support, food support, right? There's so many needs that are going unmet, but we are lucky in Portland that we have a thriving nonprofit and philanthropy you know, group of organizations. All of our nonprofits are consistently, year after year, stepping in and doing what our policymakers fail to do. So I just wanted to give a plug to that, and we'll close with some more information about that. Do we have any more callers?
Yes, I believe Francis is waiting patiently to say something. Francis?
Yay, Francis!
Hi. I agree with your last caller. I think what they're doing in Utah is pretty amazing. And one thing that I've noticed, when people are in some kind of housing here, there's a program attached, and usually sobriety is part of the program, and if you drink, you're kicked out. And in Utah, they don't do that. If you fall off the wagon, they help you get back on the wagon, but you don't lose your place in the process. So I appreciate what they're doing down there. I've been looking into transformative and restorative justice, and the profits made in the prison industry and the war industry. And I started reading some books by Chris Hedges. And it's interesting, I just picked up this book that he wrote called Our Class, and it's about prisoners and a class that he taught there, and I have just started reading it, so I can't really say too much about it. But I did notice that in the introduction, he had quotes from Michelle Alexander.
Yeah.
If I may, I'll read it. It's pretty short. She says, "Criminals, it turns out, are the one social group in America we have permission to hate." In colorblind, quote-unquote, America, criminals are the new whipping boys. They are entitled to no respect and little moral concern. Like the, quote-unquote, colored in the years following emancipation, criminals today are deemed a characterless and purposeless people, deserving of our collective scorn and contempt. When we say someone was treated like a criminal, what we mean to say is that he or she was treated as less than human, like a shameful creature. Hundreds of years ago, our nation put those considered less than human in shackles. Less than 100 years ago, we relegated them to the other side of town. Today, we put them in cages. Once released, they find that a heavy and cruel hand has been laid upon them. And I want us to think about that, including the fact that there's a lot of people that should not even be in prison because they've been railroaded there or profiled or whatever. Mm-hmm. But even if they did commit a crime, the manner in which we treat people who have been found guilty of a crime is ridiculous. It's ruthless. It's wrong. It's inhuman. And why we continue to think it's okay to do that and just dismiss these people as non-people is amazing to me. And we kind of do that with homeless people too, but you know, we can also put them in the victim role too. But to me, it all comes down to respect. And you know, if people are committing crime, maybe we should figure out why they're committing crime. And that would go into the transformative justice, where we have resources available to people rather than leaving them out there with nothing. That's my spiel for today. I don't have anything else to say, but I'm interested in reading some more of this man's book, though, because he does talk about the profit from war and how war is pretty much futile also. Mm-hmm. So,
well, thank you so much as always, Francis,
you guys
for your
take
call.
Care.
Appreciate you.
Take care.
All right, we've got Mark on the line as well. Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for your passion. Chris Hedges also said recently that by no means can we call ourselves a democracy, that we are an oligarchy, that the richest are the ones who make the decisions, and the elected are not the deciders. Public defenders and housing aren't decorations, they're imperatives. And there are signs of a system collapse. To me, the old downtown post office, which has been vacant for months and months, would be an ideal place for a village of SROs, single resident occupancy. They would be close to services, close to public transportation. They're not blocking the views of the super rich. I don't understand why City Hall is absolutely deaf. I've sent emails, many emails, and I've never received a response. I think if we had a small demonstration outside City Hall, maybe every week, once a week, maybe even just 10 or 20 people, that might make a difference. I don't know. I see this as a kairos or decision or emergency time. This is not everyday time. We're in apocalyptic times, and we face a collective cowardice among the ruling class. They don't seem to see that helping the weakest helps the public spirit and helps them. What do you think about this?
I mean, I feel like what's interesting, and this kind of goes with what Francis was saying,
yeah.
We have literally in our society demonized people, specifically houseless people, who, if we've never been houseless, and I have, who we've created this boogeyman of these kinds of people, and we've said all kinds of things about them, right? We've laid mental illness on them. We've laid every kind of ill of society on this group of people, and it has allowed us to turn our backs. So if we were to demonstrate, right, who would show up? And I think that is what I'm calling us all to do, to show up for people
right.
who, through the systemic failures, are in a situation that they did not create, they did not want, and that without resources and advocacy, they're never going to get out of, right? So who are we in this situation? We're bystanders if we don't stand up and do something.
And we're always faced with the myth, the argument of personal responsibility, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, which is really impossible. And this is a collective failure, and we should be able to see that this downtown post office area is a perfect area, and this would be an incremental step. It's not going to solve everything. Now, there are some people who say that the main reason why there's no action on the homeless, the tent people, is that this is a way to get people to keep working.
Mm-hmm. I heard that.
You know, Well, that's my perspective, too. We don't lack the resources. There should be public defenders. I spent a year in law school, and I'm so thankful that I left, that the Lord led me out of that terrible situation. So civil society should have a power, should have a responsibility, and you can't leave things to the market. You can't leave things to the wealthy people. When an injury to one is an injury to all, and there's good in every person. Now we have to remember, we have to include Martin Luther King and the whole, countervailing traditions. We're in a desperate situation. The federal government is, for the time being, impotent, inept, and inert. And there must be a way, an end to the war, the senseless war, filling the Ukraine with weapons is just absurd. And so thanks for your passion, and hopefully, you'll be awakening people, and because private interest is really public interest.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your call, Mark. Appreciate it. Looks like we got Susan on the line. Susan.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you,
Good
Tracy,
morning.
For doing this. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you good.
All right. Thank you. I think this is just a wonderful question you posed, what to do with $27 million, and I would concur with all the previous speakers to say that, housing is just such a fundamental basic thing. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy and what people need, we have to really go back to the very basics. We need to be warm, we need to be housed, we need to be fed, we need to be healthy, social, all of those kinds of things. But here, for what it's worth, here's my take on your wonderful question. I would certainly have a coordinated approach to using this money, and that would involve, many of the other callers and yourselves have said this, many of the other resources that are available in communities to help out folks who are houseless. I would take a really hard look at what places in the United States have been successful or more successful than other places, and why. And I would certainly not put up with any bellyachers about how much money we're spending on people who may not be worthy, or as the last caller said, can't pull this up by their own bootstraps. Folks who are houseless and homeless have so often been severely traumatized, and for anybody to expect that they're going to be able to access and help themselves the way somebody else who hasn't had that experience is just folly. Also, I think the approach needs to be one that looks at all the reasons why people are houseless, and they are many and varied, as I understand it, and you probably know much more mm-hmm. about this than I do, but just from your professional experience and your teaching and everything. But, some people are mentally ill. Some people are just down on their luck. Some people are coming off addictions. There are a whole lot of mixed reasons, I think, why somebody is not in a home and or in a house. And I think that needs to be looked at. I would also say that I don't care how much. We have $27 million and we've got X number of people that need to be helped. I would put the per capita spending, I don't care if it looks excessive. If we're setting out to help people, then we spend what needs to be spent on doing what needs to be done to help every individual person that we can help, as far as that money will go. And I'm talking about things like getting people into housing and making daily visits for medications, for making daily visits to make sure that they have adequate food, to make daily visits to check up on their general well-being, that as they're able, promoting increased socialization and contingency with other people for as long as it takes and for as much money as it takes. Some people will respond much more quickly than others because they probably haven't been as traumatized or they're not as needy. For others, it may take years and may take a great deal of resources, but I think that's all about what's being a good person is all about, is helping people who need the help. So I don't know if I've made any sense at all.
Yes,
but I would not put up for one. Okay, I would not put up for 1 minute with any belly aching about, look how much money we're spending on these people and do they deserve it. Everybody as a human being deserves it. People who are down and need the help need our help, and it is a moral and ethical thing to do to step up and help. So that's my solution to your answer to your question. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. I love it.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
All right.
Thanks for your call. So, you know, I want to just kind of go back to what Susan was saying, right? If housing is a human right, why do you need to earn $145,000 per year to afford a median-priced home in Portland, Oregon, right? We have to begin asking these questions, because housing can't be a human right if it's left to the market to decide how much it costs, right? I don't know very many people who make $145,000 a year to buy a median income, right? This is the median. I also want to name, you know, this is going back to Mark's comments, that in the state of Oregon, 44% of Oregonians voted no to repeal the language from the state constitution that prohibits slavery or involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime. Do y'all hear me? like for real, for real. 44% of Oregonians were like, no, we actually should, you know, create more servitude for crimes in this, like, are you serious? I just want to name that is the prevailing thinking for 44% of Oregonians who were like, no, why would we get rid of the slavery language? We can do that to criminals. Once again, right, we've created a dehumanization process for people who commit crimes, also for people who are houseless. And we need to look inward. I really, truly believe that. Looks like we got Robbie on the line. Robbie.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I really wanted to piggyback on the Chris Hedges stuff that's going on. I really respect that author. My favorite book is Wages of Rebellion. But to one of the other callers' points, I've looked extensively into the inner workings of our system, and I think Chris Hedges, that's what he's defined himself as well. He takes a flashlight and looks at the inner workings of our system, and what the other caller had said was that they almost I'll put it this way, they use homelessness as a deterrent to keep the workers working. I used to work in the mortgage industry in 2009. I guess I was the bad guy. I felt like I had sold my soul to the devil right when I was out of high school, working for a mortgage collections company using the Obama bailout program to modify loans to get them to a 2% interest rate sometimes, so that they would be within a 31 housing to income ratio. And when I was working there, I noticed right off the bat that the TARP bailout, which was on taxpayers' money, bailed out the banks. And then my job was to then try to stop the foreclosures from happening, but we wouldn't approve it if the bank didn't get more money out of modifying the loan. So this was like a win-win-win on that whole front. But you have to look a little bit deeper, because you get a perspective like Chris Hedges when you see that the Federal Reserve uses tools in the mortgage. They call them their tools for controlling inflation and stuff. But basically what they do is they decide what the cost of interest is going to be for home loans. They decide what the cost of, you know, virtually everything that we're going to be paying for in this high market system. And so what happens is you come to the realization that this is entirely intentional. The reason why they're, you know, the city doesn't seem, you know, flounders around like it can't really do much is because of the bureaucracy inside of it, and the fact that they are using this as a deterrent to keep us in our jobs and to make sure that we don't rebel or ask for more wages, because on the other side of that coin, if we don't win, I could be out on the street. And so this is how they then dehumanize people. They say, oh, well, they're just lazy, they're not working, they just want it free, blah blah blah, you know, that whole argument of the side. And in reality, what's happening is they, you know, people's wages are slowly going up while the cost of living is extremely going up, and this divide is for control. It's very simple when you look at it in those terms. And so, you know, we had, you know, gosh, 6-8 years ago, I think there was on the, it came up that maybe they could convert the Wapatawo, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but the Wapatawo jail into a housing center for people. And I don't know, it was very interesting because everything was lined up. They were donating the property to the city to do that. And then there were some, you know, and there were some small, I would say minor problems. I mean, first of all, I guess nobody would really want to be inside an ex-jail. You know, I guess that could look kind of wrong. But, you know, what's worse, you know, being cold and, you know, stuck outside, or, you know, being in some type of a thing. But ultimately, my thing was, is I think they didn't approve it because they don't want a solution that would actually find you know, a meaningful, I don't know. And, you know, I don't think that they want that, because this deterrent is what's keeping us at work. And I guess that's what I'll just mention on that.
Thank you, Robbie. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I feel like the deterrent factor of, like, visible homelessness is to scare folks straight, right? Scare them into continuing to overpay for education so they can get a better job and not be like those people, right? And because we've dehumanized those people, we also don't want to be like them for those reasons, right? We don't want to be dehumanized. And so it's a spiral that we continue to cycle in. And what I'll say is that, you know, we've got snow coming tonight in parts of the metro area. We've got snow coming Wednesday. It's going to be extremely cold. And these are our neighbors. Like, let's get it together, Portland. We are no longer able to rely on policymakers to do the right thing. So it's going to require that we mobilize ourselves in protection of the people who are in our community who are in most need. I mean, that's pretty much it. I don't know what else to say about that. But I really thank you for your call and what you shared today, Robbie. So, it is Giving Tuesday, and of course, because I put money aside to be able to give and support the nonprofits that I feel are giving and providing the most benefit for our community, I want to invite folks to check out Willamette Week's Give Guide. Please, of course, give to KBOO Radio so we can continue bringing you some great programming, some amazing music and shows, just like this one, Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy. But within the Give Guide, there are a ton of nonprofits, right? There's more than 20 nonprofits for civil and human rights, if you want to give to that cause. There are 27 nonprofits for community, the environment, education. There's one for homes and supporting housing. There's one for health and human services and hunger. Please just choose a nonprofit, and if you are able to do so, Give every penny count, even if you can only give $5. I encourage us to really think about our own personal responsibility, right? So we often talk about the personal responsibility of people who are in these situations. What's our own personal responsibility to support our larger community and understand that we are a community and we are not islands unto ourselves? And so we have to do what's required of us in these kinds of times. And also, right, when we think about, you know, our upcoming mayoral election that might be happening in the future, what kind of leader, what kind of policymakers do we need at the table? How do we turn off next door? How do we stop being inundated with these bleeds at leads and continuing to fuel this ideology around the people who commit crimes and the people who have less than us as somehow not fully deserving of dignity and resources to support their health, their ability to exist, all of that, right? We really have to begin this process. So I just want to make sure that we don't have any other callers. We have time for one more call. So if you are so inclined, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I think I've shared multiple times, I am a regular supporter of multiple nonprofits, including the Oregon Food Bank, which has done amazing work for me and the people that I serve in my regular job. Amazing resource, as well as Outside In, a resource for younger people who are struggling with houselessness, and Street Roots. Street Roots is a regular donation for me as well. So just giving you some ideas about, you know, the folks that I support, and hoping that you jump on the bandwagon. I think, you know, going back to the conversation about the Public Defender's Office, what I would love to see is, you know, not putting pressure on Mike Schmidt, the progressive DA, who literally, I think this is all happening to try and shift that, you know, reality as well, to get, you know, kind of a Republican tough on crime kind of DA person back in that seat. But that we can rally around Mike Schmidt and also name the systemic issues that are happening in our city and our county and our state, because this is not just a Multnomah County issue. This is a statewide issue. We've got 763 people who are waiting in the jails across the state to see a trial date, and will not see a trial date until they get a public defender. And also, this is also a call out to support the public defenders who are still doing this work. The 31% of the people needed who are still doing the work and would have to work 26 hours a day for a work week to be able to serve these clients. They need our support as well. I can't imagine having that kind of pressure on me. And that kind of job, we think about burnout, we think about kind of the stress levels of knowing that you're doing a job that's pretty undoable at the capacity, and that we need to also put some pressure on the legal system, whether that's the education system that produces attorneys, to say we actually need to pay our public defenders, and we need to be thinking about who is able to access the education needed to be able to do this work. Because I think we'd have a completely different system if the people who are in the public defender's office looked a lot more like their clients, right? So if we had more people of color who were public defenders, if we had more people who have been in interesting situations, like potentially, you know, previously houseless or unsheltered, right? If we had people who truly reflected the clients that they serve, I think the outcomes would be very different as well.
Tracy, so, do we still want to try to fit in a call?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, here's Barth. Go ahead, Barth.
A couple things. You talked about Hoovervilles. There was a Hooverville in Sullivan's Gulch, which is where the Banfield 84 runs through now, and Lloyd Center, the end of it is at Lloyd Center. And so that's a reality that's historically placed here in town. People don't think about that, but that was one place where the downtrodden, as it were, cohabitated with everybody else and made shanties and lived in Portland. You also talked about if lawyers looked a lot more like their clients. If we had a subsidized college education, then that would be more of a reality. And a third point, which I seem to be brain draining here. Let's support the radio station, folks. It's the only way you hear about these things and let you come and give your two cents, as I often do. But also make a difference in your local world by knowing what's going on. And if you know, you can help. And if you can help, it makes a difference. If it makes a difference, your world improves too. That's all for me. Good day.
Thank you so much. We're going to end on that note. Once again, check out the Give Guide, Willamette Week. Lots of amazing nonprofits to donate to who are doing great work in the community, as well as learn more about these issues that are happening in your community and give to KBOO Radio if you have the opportunity to do so, so we can continue bringing you amazing programming. Signing off for Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. We'll see you back next Tuesday. Thank you.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public